ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It is Thursday, the 15th of February. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, the latest unemployment data is released. What does it tell us about how the economy is tracking? And she said yes. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announces his engagement to partner Jodie Hayden.
I'm wishing him well. Congratulations.
I didn't vote for him and I hope there's a change at the next federal election.
So this won't change your mind about him?
Definitely not.
Weddings are always fun, so good on him and I hope he enjoys the engagement and the wedding party to come.
First today, veterans are planning to launch a class action after the medical files of up to 300,000 current and former members of the ADF and some of their family members were shared for two decades without informed consent. The Department of Veterans Affairs passed on the data to the University of South Australia under a program called MATES, which has now been shut down due to ethical concerns. The law firm Gordon Legal says a class action against the department could pave the way for compensation. Rachel Hayter reports, and the names of some veterans in this story have been changed to protect their privacy.
If you're a member of the Defence Force with an orange, white or gold card, the Australian government helps pay for your medical care. But for the past 20 years, the details of that medical care has been secretly shared with a university.
All of their data is being transferred to the University of South Australia, fully identifiable.
Julie Anderson is an advocate who was honoured with a Medal of the Order of Australia in 2020 for her service to veterans. Her husband, Charlie, served in the Gulf War in the early 1990s and says he's among up to 300,000 veterans whose privacy has been breached by a program called MATES, which was run by the Department of Veterans Affairs for 20 years until it was axed this week.
Oh, it was absolutely horrifying. You know, my husband was really distraught.
MATES stands for Veterans Medicines Advice and Therapeutics Education Services Program, which the DVA says aims to improve the use of medicines and related health services in the veteran community. Gary served with the Royal Australian Air Force for 14 years. He says his personal medical information was shared with the University of South Australia without his knowledge.
I have diagnosed PTSD, which manifests in several ways. And to find that that's been released to a university for research purposes without my approval is extraordinarily difficult.
Dean served with the ADF as a clerk for a decade. A Freedom of Information request revealed the extent of his personal medical history shared with UniSA.
When I did receive it, it was pretty confronting and stuff like that. Now it takes a lot for me to cry, and I did.
The MATES program was formally shut down this week. The department says the program has lost the confidence of the veteran community and it lost DVA ethics approval at the start of last week. But veteran advocate Julie Anderson wants to know how the program was allowed to run for as long as it did.
It's completely unethical and they can blame each other for not getting informed consent. But at the end of the day, we're talking about researchers who have got their hands on this huge database, and I cannot believe that not one even questioned how DVA managed to get informed consent from 300,000 participants.
More than 80 studies have been conducted based on the MATES data set. Veterans advocates say there are now ethical questions over that research. Seb O'Mara is a senior associate with Gordon Legal, investigating whether the program has breached the Privacy Act.
We've received a significant number of inquiries in relation to this issue. There's obviously a large amount of concern amongst the veteran community.
Last year, the Privacy Commissioner ordered the DVA pay $5,000 to one veteran for breaching their privacy through the MATES program. Seb O'Mara says Gordon Legal is considering seeking an injunction to stop the department from making any further disclosures of personal information. He argues the scale of the breach is up there with some of the biggest data scandals in recent years.
The Optus data breach springs to mind, but 300,000 potential victims puts it right up there.
And Optus was a hack, so this is different because it was knowingly shared rather than an external actor.
That's exactly right. There's no external criminal actor here that's played any part in the disclosure of the information that we're talking about. It was done intentionally by the department over the course of two decades.
In a statement, the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs says there has not been any unauthorised access of veteran data, and the data has not been made available publicly or for nefarious purposes. A University of South Australia spokesperson says when it became aware of questions raised with DVA, it requested the suspension of the transmission of that data.
That's Rachel Hayter reporting, and you'll be able to read the full statements from the Department of Veterans Affairs and the University of South Australia on the World Today's website. And if you're a current or former member of the ADF and this story has raised concerns for you or someone you know, you can contact Open Arms on 1800 011 046, or you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. To the economy now, and Australia's unemployment rate has risen to its highest level in 2 years. Official figures show the jobless rate hit 4.1% in January, up from 3.9% in December. The number of people employed remained relatively stable, but the number of unemployed increased by 22,000. Our reporter David Taylor joins me now. David, take us through the key points of these numbers that have been released today.
Well, Sally, I think this is a fairly significant report. We've got full-time employment rising by 11,100 and part-time decreasing by 10,600. So if you net that out, you're looking at 500 new jobs being created in January, but as you mentioned, 22,000 folks lost their job. So that is a weakness emerging, a proper weakness emerging in the labour market. Now, the participation rate stayed steady at 66.8%, and Sally, the underemployment rate increased to 6.6%.
David, what do these latest job figures tell us about how easy or how hard it is to get a job in Australia at the moment?
Look, I think it has progressively, over the past few months, as interest rates have risen and the economy has slowed, become harder. But, and this is an important but, the ABS notes that many people may have been taking some time off when they were surveyed in January, and that may, it's a sort of a statistical blip. So that may provide some answers there. Economist Leonore Rees says she's encouraged by the stability of the participation rate,
which means that we're not seeing people drop out of the workforce, which is positive. It means they're not being discouraged and dropping out. So the economy, based on the unemployment rate, looks like it is slowing down, but not dramatically.
Is this what the Reserve Bank is looking for? Does this increase or decrease the chance of another interest rate hike this year?
The Reserve Bank is looking to put the brakes on the economy to slow down some of that spending that's putting pressure on prices. So yes, even though this is a hard pill to swallow, to see the unemployment rate increasing, this is a sign that interest rates are now biting the economy.
That's economist Leonora Rees there. And David, just briefly, the cost of living is top of mind for many Australians. The RBA Governor Michelle Bullock has faced a questioning at a parliamentary hearing today. What'd she say?
Well, Sally, interestingly enough, she said there is no widespread price gouging. The RBA has had that line for quite a while now, and they're sticking to it. But there are pockets of it, that is price gouging, and that may be because competition is weak. It's an obvious point to make, but she has put that caveat around that. Here's the RBA Governor, Michelle Bullock, speaking in Parliament a short time ago.
If you've got inflation back around 2 to 3% and it's in the background, it's much more difficult, I think, for firms to use high inflation as cover for this putting up their prices.
That behaviour of raising their prices over and above what they need to do, I mean, that would, in broad terms, constitute price gouging, right?
I think that's what people are using to define price gouging, if I read the report from Professor Fells.
That's the RBA Governor Michelle Bullock facing questioning at the parliamentary hearing today, and before her, our reporter David Taylor. Consumer group Choice says the nation's major health insurers are significantly hiking premiums for hospital cover well beyond the rate approved by the federal government. Health insurers are only legally allowed to increase their premiums once a year with the health minister's approval. But Choice says they're using sneaky tactics and lifting prices for some policies beyond the approved rate. The major health funds argue the price rises are justified, as Gavin Coote reports.
When his health insurance costs kept climbing, Sydney education student Lachlan had little hesitation in cancelling his cover.
I started with private health insurance because my grandfather was paying for it, but after a while, when I started having to pay for it, the cost was too much. I needed health insurance for things like glasses because I have some pretty bad vision, and obviously optometry specialist appointments are all very expensive, but after a while, the cost of the health insurance became more than the cost of the actual appointments themselves.
Others, like Natalia, are reluctantly holding on.
I haven't used it, so I'm not really sure, but my sister has private insurance and she broke her wrist like 2 months ago, and even though she has private insurance, she still needs to pay for a rehab, and it's like $140 every session, so it's quite expensive.
Health insurers are only allowed to increase their premiums once a year with the federal government's approval. But consumer group Choice says many top-tier policies have risen by 30% in the past 3 years, which is above the 8.6% cap on increases set by the government during that time. Jody Bird is an insurance expert at Choice.
So Choice's concern is that the health insurers are essentially hiding behind that headline figure, which gets quite highly publicised, and we'll do probably over the next week, and then not disclosing the fact that the top-level hospital goer policies are increasing by much more than that average rate.
The industry is rejecting the criticism, arguing price rises go through an incredibly rigorous process. Dr. Rachel David is the CEO of Private Healthcare Australia, which represents the funds.
Health fund actuaries make detailed submissions which are reviewed by the prudential regulator, which is APRA, the Department of Health and the Minister for Health. It's hard to argue that there's any other industry whose pricing is viewed with such detailed scrutiny. And in fact, the Minister for Health has the ability to override any inappropriate pricing requests. What you've got with Gold Hospital Cover is a group of people who are at high risk of claiming. That's why they pay so much, because they've self-selected as knowing that they're going to make a claim usually within 12 months of joining. So the risk of that is factored into the price. And that's one of the downsides or unintended consequences of the government running this very rigid tiering system over health fund products.
Yuten Zhang is a professor of health economics with the University of Melbourne. She doesn't think the current system is fit for purpose.
And a lot of people don't know the government paying huge amount of money for this. Like, there are different policies providing rebates, which cost $6.7 billion a year to give people discount to buy it. But a lot of that money has been not super effective, as what we see in the data. I think there are lots of money in that industry. There are probably much better strategies that could use that money better in a different way.
That report from Gavin Coote. In Victoria, residents are cleaning up after damaging bushfires, and thousands of people are waiting for electricity to be restored after severe storms. Some locals in the Victorian town of Pomona still don't know whether their houses survived the fire that destroyed at least 24 homes. Firefighters hope to get blazes under control today. Angus Randall reports.
In Pomona, in western Victoria, many locals don't know if their house is still standing after bushfires swept through the region this week. Resident Colin McCaffer has been able to get back into town to survey the damage.
A lot of homes have just caved in. We've been fortunate enough to, only have a slight scarring of blackness on the garden and the lawn outside. We're a tight-knit community, always have been, and this will make us a lot stronger.
The blaze burnt through the Grampians National Park, fire authorities confirming dozens of homes have been lost. Horsham Incident Controller Peter Shaw hopes he'll get a better idea of the destruction today.
It's been very quiet for us overnight. We've had crews on the fire ground that have been dealing with just the few spot fires that are within the control lines that we've got. And we've got in the order at this stage of about 25 houses that have been lost, but we're still assessing the rest.
Not everyone has been allowed into Pomonal yet, but power has been restored to most of the area and emergency services are clearing trees from roads and power lines. Mark Gunning is from the Country Fire Authority. He can understand the frustration, but says the fire ground is still dangerous.
People need to know the answer, you know, what have I lost? What do I need to do? We need to facilitate that next journey in their life as soon as possible. So I want it to happen as soon as we can get there. But at the same time, we got through the weather on our catastrophic day without anyone being seriously hurt or worse. And we don't want a tree to fall on someone now.
Emergency relief payments have been made available for eligible community members whose homes have been impacted by the fires and storms. Once the fire danger is contained, the full clean-up can begin. Bob Sanders is the mayor of the local Ararat City Council.
It's still all under emergency services out there, so there's not a lot that us as council can do besides we've sent some generators out there, sent water out and done a few things like that. But, the emergency services, until they actually let us in, there's not a great lot we can actually do.
It's just one of the many communities dealing with the fallout from a week of extreme weather. Across Victoria, thousands are still waiting for power to be restored after storms knocked out major transmission lines. Five hospitals in the state's south and east are relying on generators for power, and one Thaggy hospital on the southeast coast has cancelled all elective surgeries for today. Shane McBride is from the State Emergency Service.
As of 5:30 this morning, about 77,000 properties are still experiencing unplanned power outages, down from about 250,000 from yesterday. So the power companies are working very, very hard to get that reinstated as soon as possible, and from 250,000 back to 77,000 is a pretty good result overnight. It could be next couple of days before some areas, I suppose more of those regional sort of localised areas may see power for the next couple of days. So it could be a couple of days before the power is reinstated. But they are working very, very hard to try and get everyone back to normal.
The resilience of the electricity system will likely be on the agenda when state and federal energy ministers meet in Canberra next month.
That's Angus Randall there. Former General Prabowo Subianto has claimed victory in Indonesia's presidential election. More than 95% of the votes have been tallied in an unofficial quick count, which show the 72-year-old with 58% of the votes. Mr. Subianto's campaign used social media and AI avatars to increase his appeal to young voters and draw attention away from multiple allegations of human rights abuses during his military career. So, is his electoral success a surprise? Greg Barton is Professor of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University.
It's not a surprise this week, but, you know, go back over the last 12 months and it is one of these great shocks. It's up there with the Brexit result where we thought we knew something with a fair degree of certainty and we got a result that just completely bewilders us.
Why is it so surprising?
Well, because he doesn't seem like a guy who was about to win. He did worse in 2019 than he did in 2014. He's always had a strong popular following in Indonesia, but in a three-way contest, you would have thought even if he came out ahead of the other two, it would still be pretty much split. Instead, we're looking at results that suggest he may have got 58%. Indonesian voters went to the polls wanting continuity. They wanted effectively a third term of Jokowi. They can't have that because there's a two-term limit in Indonesia. And Jokowi gave his endorsement counterintuitively to his old rival but longtime cabinet member, Prabowo Subianto. And it's the basis of Jokowi's endorsement, Jokowi with a popularity rating of 77%. That's what slid Prabowo to victory.
How important were young voters in this election and also the use of social media to make Prabowo Subianto appear almost as a younger candidate and really to wash some of his historical record away?
I think that washing of the historical record is key. I mean, the Indonesian word that's used with the AI-generated avatars for Prabowo and for the Gibran, Jokowi's son, who's his running mate, has Jokowi coming across as the sort of cute uncle. The word used is gemoy, Now, I don't think that ensured his victory, but what it meant in an election where around 52% of voters were 40 years old or younger, Generation X or millennial, it meant that they weren't inclined to look at history books. And it's hard in Indonesia actually to get a sense of what happened during the Suharto era and that transition in 98 where Prabowo was unceremoniously pushed out of the military. It's assumed because partly of his kidnapping of activists at that time, but a long history of human rights abuses alleged against him. The promotion of him as a friendly uncle as opposed to a scary ex-general has worked. It wouldn't, I don't think, guarantee him the presidency by itself. But with Jokowi saying, here's my guy, it'll be more of the same, it's continuity if you vote for him, that was enough to get it.
If Prabowo Subianto is president of Indonesia, what does that mean for Australia's relationship with Indonesia?
Well, I think that the first question to ask ourselves is this going to be good for Indonesia? Most things that are good for Indonesia in a general sense end up being good for us. Prabowo doesn't appear to have any particular animosity towards Australia, so there's not a particular history there where he's going to feel he has to sort of pay back past slights. The question is, we know he's not at heart a Democrat. How quickly will democracy slide under Prabowo? Or will, in fact, if he goes ahead and does what he promises, elect a cabinet of the best people, a technocratic cabinet, will that end up a fairly reasonable outcome for Indonesia? And if that's the case, it would be a good outcome for Australia.
That's Greg Barton, Professor of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University. Finally today, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has announced his engagement to partner Jodie Hayden, making him the first sitting PM to do so. It also means Australia could have its first prime ministerial wedding. Jodie Hayden is the latest in a long line of spouses and partners of Australian PMs. Stephanie Smale reports.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and his partner, Jodie Hayden, are making it official, announcing their engagement on social media. Well-wishers had these messages for the pair in Brisbane.
I'm wishing him well. Congratulations.
Weddings are always fun, so good on him, and I hope he enjoys the engagement and the wedding party to come.
It's nice for absolutely anyone to get engaged, so just because he's Prime Minister, I'm not overly excited, to be quite honest. If you could tell me a complete stranger got engaged, I'd feel the same.
Others weren't as excited about the news.
I didn't vote for him and I hope there's a change at the next federal election.
So this won't change your mind about him?
Definitely not.
What about you? What do you think?
I'm in the same boat, we're sisters, so.
It's the first engagement of a sitting Prime Minister and could be the first wedding for the nation's top politician too. The pair opened up about their relationship during the 2022 federal election campaign. This was how Jodie Hayden described her feelings about the Prime Minister after he was involved in a serious car accident on Channel 7's Spotlight program in 2022.
The overwhelming sense of what if I lose him? And I knew then that, I love him and I love him deeply.
I'm lucky.
Mr Albanese had previously ended a 19-year marriage and was only the second unmarried Prime Minister to take office. Ms Hayden has already joined him on official foreign trips, including to the United States last year. Political historian Professor Chris Wallace says Jodie Hayden has helped boost the Prime Minister's popularity.
It really does reflect, I think, a pretty substantive and good relationship that everyone in Canberra has observed since Albanese has become Prime Minister. So she's definitely been a plus for Albanese.
So what is the role of a Prime Minister's significant other, or in this instance, soon-to-be wife, in federal politics these days? Jodie Hayden has indicated she'll continue her own career pursuits and intends to avoid political commentary.
It varies from Prime Minister to Prime Minister. Some are incredibly influential. Jeanette Howard, spouse of John Howard, springs to mind. She was always considered very influential on how John Howard played his politics. Others, of course, don't assume so much prominence. Someone like, for example, Zara Holt probably wasn't a big influence on Harold Holt's prime ministership. But it can range. And a good spouse is certainly a big help to a prime minister who wants to succeed.
While the engagement is a happy development personally for Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, some point out it can't hurt politically either. Dr. Blair Williams is a lecturer in Australian politics at Monash University.
political leaders often use their families, you know, their partners and their children to further their own political image and to appear more relatable to the average Australian or the general public. I guess this provides a good news story in politics, and it shows, I guess, a softer side of Albanese.
It's Monash University politics lecturer Dr. Blair Williams ending that report from Stephanie Smale. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara. Stay safe.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For a while, Israel declared the Gaza city of Rafah a safe zone. More than a million people flocked there, but it's now under attack. Today, reporter Nicole Johnston on the growing international calls for Israel to pull back and what she saw during a rare trip inside Gaza. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.